and we go into a polygamous society, and here's a guy with four wives. Well, then he hears the gospel, and he says, I believe in Jesus Christ, I want to be baptized. They say, you've got four wives, what do we do now? Say, well, obviously what you do is pick three of them out in the street. So he lines them up and takes a good look and decides, let me see, you know, which one do I want to keep? And he throws them out in the street, and because they aren't trained as secretaries or nurses, they become prostitutes, and the man gets elected to the board of deacons and bowls on the church bowling team. But if the same guy says, you know, I can't do that. I really can't do that. I married these four women, and they are my wives, and so, you know, I want to become a Christian. Then we've said, sorry, baby. You know, you can come, and you can hear the word. You can't be baptized. You can't be a Christian. Now, people, you know, that whole thing is topsy-turvy now, and people are worrying about them and say, maybe those orders of creation aren't quite as tight and changeless as we thought they were. Politically, the problem was tremendously agonizing in the time of Hitler because the Nazis built on that orders of creation thing, and they said that the state is ordained by God. When the July 20th plot failed and that bomb went off and blew Hitler's pants off, but that's about all, he went in his rags to meet Mussolini coming in on the train an hour later, and he didn't even wash his face. And Benito got off the train. He says, Benito, God is with us. Obviously, he protected me, you know, from being killed. God has ordained the orders of creation. He's ordained the state. So Paul Schneider, who was a confessing church pastor, very early in the game, refused to let the Nazis participate in a funeral service in his congregation. They came to his door, and they knocked on the door, and they quoted Romans 13, obey the powers that be, for they're ordained by God, and they hauled him off the concentration camp. He's the first martyr of the confessing church. So Bonhoeffer, among others, said, you simply can't handle family, state, church in a static, changeless, absolute, ordained way. There's got to be some movement in here. And so in a book, Creation and Fall, instead of talking about orders of creation, he talked about orders of preservation. Bonhoeffer never threw out everything and said, the state is bad, therefore everybody do his own thing. But what he did was to take the thing and take it from a spatial and put it into a temporal context and get some dynamic and movement into it. So he talked about orders of creation, orders of preservation. Then later, he talked about the divine mandate, which is a word which carries a connotation of the command of God. Now, let me read you a little passage about that. He says, God's commandment is the speech of God to man. Both in its contents and in its form, it is concrete speech to concrete man. God's commandment leaves no room for application or interpretation. It leaves room only for obedience or disobedience. God's commandment cannot be found and known in detachment from time and place. It can only be heard in a local and temporal context. If God's commandment is not clear, definite, and concrete to the last detail, then it's not God's commandment. Either God does not speak at all, or else he speaks to us as definitely as he spoke to Abraham and Jacob and Moses, and as definitely as in Jesus Christ he spoke to the disciples, and through his apostles to the Gentiles. Now, does this mean that at every moment of our lives we may be informed of the commandment of God by some special divine direct inspiration? Or that at every moment, in an unmistakable and unequivocal manner, God causes the accent of eternity to rest on a particular action which he wills? It sounds as though he's talking that way. He says, no, it doesn't mean that. For the concreteness of the divine commandment consists in its historicity, in its timeliness. It confronts us in historical form. Does this mean, then, that we are utterly lacking in certainty in the face of the extremely varying claims of historical powers, and that, so far as the commandment of God is concerned, we're groping in darkness? It sounds like that. No. the reason why it does not mean this is that God makes this commandment heard in definite historical form. We cannot now escape the question where and in what historical form God makes this commandment known. For the sake of simplicity and clarity, and even at the risk of direct misunderstanding, we will begin by answering this question in the form of a thesis. God's commandment, which is manifested in Jesus Christ, comes to us in the church, in family, in labor, and in government. So what he does is to take that old orders of creation business and say, yes, God does work through structures. He does work through institutions. He does work through corporate entities. But those corporate entities are not absolute. They're not changeless. They are conditioned by time and history. And I have to ask always, what is the will of God? Not just for me as an individual, but what is the will of God for me in the context of my communal relationships and responsibilities? I'll lob out a couple more quickies, and then we'll talk. He talks, one of his categories is the permission to live. And this is one way in which Bonhoeffer says that ethics has to do with freedom, with gospel, with grace, more than it has to do with law, demand, obligation. He says the command of God permits man to be man before God. It allows the flood of life to flow freely. It lets man eat, drink, sleep, work, rest, and play. It doesn't interrupt him. It doesn't continually ask him whether he ought to be sleeping, eating, working, or playing, or whether he has some more urgent duties. If one thinks in terms of conscience, particularly, that is really devastating, you know, because you're always wondering, did I hear you clearly there? You know, come again. And the person who is wrapped up in that kind of an ethic is classically the unfree, uptight guy. Bonhoeffer says the command of God isn't like that. The command of God frees man. It does not make man a critic and judge of himself and of his deed, but it allows him to live and to act with certainty and with confidence in the guidance of the divine commandment. The self-tormenting and hopeless question regarding the purity of one's motives, the suspicious observation of oneself, the glaring and fatiguing light of incessant consciousness, all of these have nothing to do with the commandment of God which grants liberty to live and to act. That's of a piece with Bonhoeffer's statement in Life Together that the church is not to be constantly taking its spiritual pulse. The church is to serve and sing and pray and worship and give and love. The church isn't to be saying, uh-oh, are we really pure? That's not the point. The command of God gives permission to live. Another one of his categories is the acceptance of guilt. I'll read this. If it is responsible action, if it is action which is concerned solely and entirely with the other man, it is. If Bonhoeffer's ethics always ask the question, what is the will of God in the total context? What can I do that will get in on what God is doing? It doesn't ask, how can I be good, or how can I do good? Bonhoeffer says that the Christian has to abandon those questions. That's the way you begin. You abandon the question, what is the good? How can I be good? That's not the point. The point is, how can I get in on what God is doing? If it's responsible action, if it's action which is concerned solely and entirely with the other man, if it arises from selfless love for the real man who is our brother, then, precisely because this is so, it cannot wish to shun the fellowship of human guilt. That's a great phrase, the fellowship of human guilt. Jesus took upon himself the guilt of all men, and for that reason, every man who acts responsibly becomes guilty. If any man tries to escape guilt in responsibility, he detaches himself from the ultimate reality of human existence, and what is more, he cuts himself off from the redeeming mystery of Christ bearing guilt without sin, and he has no share in the divine justification which lies upon this event. He sets his own personal innocence above his responsibility for men, and he's blind to the more irredeemable guilt which he incurs precisely in this. He is blind also to the fact that real innocence shows itself precisely in a man's entering into the fellowship of guilt for the sake of other men. I remember at a conference that I participated in, I was talking about this, and I used Sartre's play Dirty Hands. Some of you know that. There's some beautiful passages in that book which say that anyone who is going to act responsibly in this sin-infested world is going to get dirty hands. That's what Bonhoeffer's talking about. He shares the fellowship of human guilt, the acceptance of guilt. And the president of the institution where I was wasn't at that particular session. And the next hour, we all gathered for a communion service, and this guy gave a sermon entitled Clean Hands. And he talked for 20 minutes about that the Christian is one who has clean hands. And then he just, you know, rang the changes on that scene. It was really a terrible moment. Bonhoeffer says that the Christian is one who has dirty hands, and he says that over and over again in Life Together. We talked about confession. He says the problem in the church is often that the breakthrough to fellowship doesn't occur, because although people in the church have fellowship together as good people, they don't have fellowship together as sinners. That's a total disaster, because the church is not made up of good people. The church is made up of bad people who admit it and to receive God's forgiveness. That's what the church is about. And that's why I think that we are on the real edge of losing the gospel, of losing the grace of God, because there is a whole vast movement in the church that seems to be saying that unless you do my political thing, unless you're against, I'm trying to say this last night a little bit, you know, if you aren't against J. Edgar Hoover, you're not a Christian, period. Now, what in the world kind of business is that? I mean, I happen to be against J. Edgar Hoover. That doesn't make me a Christian. That's a decision by a Christian in a concrete place in a concrete time. But that which ties me to my brothers in the body of Christ is not my political decision, but my acceptance of guilt and my sharing with them in the forgiveness of God through Jesus Christ. So what Bonhoeffer does really is to take seriously the gospel, to take seriously grace, to take seriously the forgiveness of sins, and to ask the question, what does that mean for ethics? He says that the problem in the church is that although, maybe to a large extent, at least to some extent, we've caught on theologically to grace and the gospel, when we go to living, then we live by the law. Bonhoeffer says, no, it's not like that. If we're saved by the gospel, then let's live by the gospel too. And then ethics takes on a whole different shape. And these are just some of the categories that Bonhoeffer uses. Permission to live, acceptance of guilt, the divine mandate, recovery of the natural, and what one has to do in order to get some kind of pattern out of that is to take those pieces and somehow put them together, and I think it's very possible to do that. So, what would you like to say or raise? Yes?
What you're talking about the dirty hands, I'm wondering if the makers of the outside world itself,
it can break out of it by preaching the gospel. I mean, that's true, that people outside the church are always telling us that. They say, well, you're supposed to be so good. You're not so good. I'm as good as you are. Then we ought to say, yeah, yeah. That's right. You are. Huh? I've got a neighbor who's much better than I am. Not only as good, he's better than I am. That's not what Christianity is. And so we've got to tell ourselves, and we've got to tell those people outside the church what in the world Christianity is about. And it's about the grace of God. It's about God accepting us in spite of our unacceptability. We've got to preach the gospel. But we get intimidated. People come and say, hey, you're no better than anybody else. And we say, oh yeah, oh yeah, yeah we are. And that's that's the, you know, exactly the wrong reaction.
Don't you think we should start calling our churches different by different names, like Sinners Lutheran Church?
Right. Oh, yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, when I'm doing speech card preaching, I always end it by saying, sinners and only welcome, and only sinners are welcome at First Lutheran tomorrow morning. But on the street corner, where the town prostitute is always there, and the town idiot, and so on, and so they call the preacher back to the vacation to get rid of this school. Yeah. I was going to say one gimmick that I picked up in college from my college president. Couple of us are with you, says we always want to make Christianity the lint out of our spiritual belly
button.
You commented on the different bases of what we have to do. This is an awful issue about the situation that, for example,
you certainly have a base on which to operate, but the point about those different bases on which an absolutist ethic is built is that all of those, conscience, natural law, Bible verses, reason, they are all based on reality as essentially changeless. They are variations on a theme. And that's also true about situation ethics, that no matter what base a situation ethics is built on, it's a moving base. The base is change and time and history. But there are variations on that theme, and I think very important variations. For instance, Joseph Fletcher thinks that he is building an ethic on a universal kind of moving base, whether one believes in God or not. And he says that it's love. Now, I would say that Joseph Fletcher is the absolutist of all absolutists. He's not really a situationist, because he's got that love up in the sky somewhere, and actually operates deductively from that. Bonhoeffer does not think that he's building an ethic for every man. He's asking the question, who is Jesus Christ for us today? He's talking about how a Christian responds to the question, what ought I to do? So there are similarities in those spaces, yeah.
Inevitably, you get the point with words, like a Bible verse. Would be helpful to me if you would comment on how
Yeah, I've not read the whole literature in German, but I've read a good bit of it. I think that the translations are essentially good. I think that there are, for instance, important fine points. John Godsey, who wrote one of the first